Hello and welcome. I'm Dr. Emma Cefaloni, and on behalf of CME Outfeeders, I would like to welcome and thank you for joining us for today's educational activity titled Clinical Insights on Recent Advances in Spinal Muscular Atrophy. This activity is brought to you by CME Outfeeders, an award-winning accredited provider of continuing education for clinicians around the globe. Our goal of today's activity is to enable our learners to accurately diagnose and treat patients with SMA. So please send us your questions and feedback. Again, I'm Dr. Emma Cefaloni. I'm the Robert C. and Rosalind H. Griggs Professor in Experimental Therapeutics of Neurologic Disease, Professor of Neurology, Pediatrics, and Obstetrics and Gynecology, and Director of Pediatric Neuromuscular Medicine at the University of Rochester, School of Medicine and Dentistry, Rochester, New York. Joining me today are my colleagues, Dr. John Branzema and Nancy Coons. John is a neurologist and neuromuscular section head at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, an assistant professor of clinical neurology at the Perelman School of Medicine, University of Pennsylvania. Great to have you with us, John.
Pleasure to be here.
Nancy is a child neurologist and medical director of the MATSA Foundation Neuromuscular Disorders Program and Muscular Dystrophy Association Care Center at the Ann and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago. She's also professor of pediatrics and neurology at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, Chicago. Happy to have you with us, Nancy.
Thank you.
The learning objectives of these educational activities are: review the pathophysiology and therapeutic targets of SMA, apply the current recommendation for screening and early diagnosis of SMA, and evaluate the latest clinical data on the efficacy and safety of approved and emerging therapies for SMA. Let's start with an overview of SMA. So SMA is the leading genetic cause of infant death, with an estimated incidence of about 1 in 10,000 live births in the United States, with some geographical variation. And in 2016, there was approximately an estimation of about 9,000 individual total for all types of SMA in the United States living with the disease. And it's interesting because it's the definition, the FDA definition of a rare disease is 200,000 or less. So we're really thinking about an ultra-rare disease, and yet something that for neurologists is very important and not so uncommon. And the heterozygous carrier is about 1 in 50. So, Nancy, tell us a little bit about the natural history of SMA, especially the type 1, the most severe form.
Well, SMA has been described by clinicians for over 100 years. And at the beginning, there was some controversy about whether the infants who presented with the lower motor neuron weakness and hypotonia and decreased reflexes had the same disorder as some of the older children or young adults who had a milder form of the disease with the same muscle weakness and low muscle stretch reflexes. But in 1995, the gene was identified. It's in this most common form of SMA, it's the survival motor neuron gene SMN1. And this has allowed people to first clarify that there really is a clinical spectrum of SMA from infant onset to young adult, milder form of the disease, as well as to unify groups of children who have the same genetic disorder so that a natural history can be identified and described. A group of expert clinicians in the northeastern part of the United States has published a natural history of untreated SMA based on their patients. And you can see it on this slide. This emphasizes the most frequent type of SMA, which is the infantile onset, by definition with onset clinically before 6 months of age, but not in the newborn period, more between 2 and 6 months of age. And what this contrasts is the typical motor milestones, which are in the green blocks, that are achieved by children over the first 2 years of life. And superimposed on that is a graph showing the survival curve and showing the progression of the disorder, not just in terms of loss of motor skills, continuously from the time the first clinical symptoms are described, but also the loss of the children, who without artificial supportive ventilation and nutrition typically don't survive beyond 2 years of age.
So this is very homogeneous for type 1. The progression of the disease is quite homogeneous, and basically by 20 months or so, the survival is virtually less than 10%. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about there is type 1 to type 3. What does that mean? And
well, historically, before they had the gene to clarify the presence of the spinal muscular atrophy of this sort, clinicians divided the children into different categories, hoping to establish a prognosis for the families. They considered type 1 infants who had onset between 2 and 6 months of age and who never achieved the ability to sit independently. Again, we've mentioned that the vast majority of these children did not survive beyond age 2. There was a milder form, it was kind of an intermediate form, where the children had slower onset, so they were able to sit independently with the onset more usually between 6 and 18 months of age, but they did not progress to be able to bear weight on their lower extremities, walk, or climb. The type 3 is quite variable, but it occurred in children after they began walking independently, anywhere from toddler years up to young adult years. And they would not begin running or climbing, or they would lose their abilities in that regard and start falling frequently. So those children frequently had normal lifespans but did not ambulate throughout their entire life.
Right, and so usually for the type 3 is the onset of symptoms is always after 18 months, but it can vary sometimes mm-hmm. even past 3 years of age. And then the mm-hmm. type 4 is quite rare, and it's really an adult form with
Correct.
Onset of symptoms 18 years right. or older. But they're, all types are progressive, it's just the rate of progression differs. So John, let's go over the genetics of SMA.
When we use the term spinal muscular atrophy, there's a broad range of genetic causes of that. But the most common is the 5q form of SMA. We call it 5q because it's on chromosome 5 involving the q arm. On this chromosome, there are two genes. The SMN1 gene is telomeric and the SMN2 gene is centromeric that are homologs. And in the vast majority of people with the classical form of SMA, they'll be missing their SMN1 gene because most or part of it is deleted, leading to it being non-functional. In the other 3% or so of patients with the classical form of SMA, they will not be having a deleted copy of SMN1, but rather a sequence change or some sort of genetic inversion, something that's leading the SMN1 gene to be non-functional. But this SMN1 gene is very important for the production of survival motor neuron or SMN protein. As we look into the genetic underpinnings of this, we can see that SMN1 gene makes SMN protein very effectively. The SMN2 gene is quite similar to SMN1. There's only about 6 or 7 nucleotides different between the two in most individuals. But one of the differences is key. It's a C to T transition around exon 7. And this transition leads to splicing that does not include exon 7 in the transcript most of the time. 90% of the time, it's not included, leading to a truncated protein being expressed, and the body sees this as non-functional and degrades it. Only about 10% of the time through alternative splicing does SMN2 successfully make full-length SMN protein.
A functional protein. Mm. That leads us, Nancy, maybe you can tell us a little bit about this, the correlation between the SMN2 copy number and the phenotype, the clinical severity of disease.
As John has indicated, the SMN2 copy number correlates with the amount of SMN protein that the individual lacking SMN1 makes. And clinicians over time have noticed that there is a correlation between the clinical presentation with the type 1 or infantile onset having fewer copies in general of the SMN2, and then the less severe cases of SMA having more copies because they have more SMN protein. The important thing to recognize is that this is our best biomarker currently available, but there is not a complete linear correlation.
Right.
As you can see from this bar graph, the majority of individuals with infantile onset have two copies of SMN2, but there are individuals who have one or three. Same thing with type 2 or the intermediate form. Most of them have three copies of SMN2, but there is some variation. It's even more variable with the milder onset of type 3.
Yeah, which is important to remember because this is something that we use practically in clinical practice to kind of discuss the prognosis, but it's not 100%. So
right.
In pre-symptomatic babies, this is the best biomarker we have, but it's by no means 100% precise.
Exactly.
So the incidence and the prevalence of SMA, the different types, is kind of important to spend a moment on this, because while the incidence, about 85% of cases are really type 1 and type 2, because type 1 morbidity and mortality is so high, when you look at prevalent cases, so established cases in our clinics, is the opposite. So the majority of the patients that survive and are followed long-term in our clinics are actually type 2 and type 3. And this is kind of practically important when we start to implementing new treatment in real-life clinic setting. SMN1 and the pathogenesis, John. Tell us a little bit about the protein and what tissues are affected and in which ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's common to all patients with SMA that they're deficient in SMN protein. But what does the survival motor neuron protein actually do in the body? That's less well understood, despite extensive work for many decades. The role in perhaps RNA trafficking and other things has been described. But what tends to happen is SMN is expressed in all tissues of the body, but in anterior horn cells in the spinal cord in particular, a deficiency of SMN leads to this progression of damage and eventual loss of motor neurons in the spinal cord and brainstem over the lifespan of an individual with SMA. But SMN also has other roles in the lower motor neuron. It's involved in nerve signaling and transport of proteins along the nerve. The neuromuscular junction is dysfunctional in people who are SMN deficient, and this may be related to the symptom of fatigue that people often describe when they have SMA, particularly those who have higher levels of function will describe fatigue as a prominent symptom.
They might
symptom.
Be able to walk and be ambulatory, but the endurance is not quite normal, for
right.
example, in the type 3.
Mm-hmm. And then the muscle itself, if it's developing denervated, it does not develop normally. If it did develop fully innervated, once you lose that innervation, it also will progress and become atrophied and dysfunctional over time. And so there's multiple potential targets within the lower motor neuron for correcting SMN deficiency. In the very severe form, sometimes we even see progression of autonomic involvement. And so this can be seen either in the congenital onset form of SMA or also in those who have more severe infantile onset as they get older, that they'll start having heart rate fluctuation, blood pressure issues, other things. So what's common to all patients with SMA is that they will have involvement of their limbs in terms of their weakness. You'll see joint contracture and weakness. GI dysfunction is quite homogeneous as well, and there can be issues with nutrition, but also motility and reflux. As you get into the more severe forms, you start to see scoliosis of the spine as an orthopedic issue, and also the bulbar involvement becomes more prominent, and you have issues with speech and swallowing, and also the respiratory morbidity that can be life-threatening for patients.
So in the severe type 1, you know, speaking and voice is not obtained, and in the type 2 can be very, very feeble. In terms of the heart, though, we don't have prominent cardiomyopathy or arrhythmia. It's more of the autonomic.
It can be autonomic involvement, except in the very severe cases. Sometimes you can see congenital onset patients with SMA having congenital heart defects as well. And then on a research basis, we've also looked at other tissues and their involvement in SMA. So we can see some research-based studies that have shown liver involvement with low insulin-like growth factor and iron overload. The spleen and the thymus can be dysfunctional in SMA, and this may be related to how people with SMA with similar levels of morbidity can be more prone to infection than other neuromuscular disorders with similar bulbar involvement. This also may be partially related to the fact that, now that we're supporting people with SMA more effectively with our multidisciplinary care, some of these other tissues are manifesting more than what was seen in the past.
And certainly with the onset of disease-modifying therapy, I think the survival is longer. I think we'll all learn together about
a new manifestation and new phenotypes.
What the long-term complications might be.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So it is crucial that we promptly and correctly diagnose SMA. And yet we know that the diagnosis of SMA remains challenging at the clinical levels. Let's take a moment to listen to some patient caregiver experiences related to the diagnosis during their SMA journey.
It took us about 2.5 months to get a correct diagnosis. We were first diagnosed with low muscle tone. We knew there was issues right away. Our doctors were not well versed on it at all. We ended up hitting the emergency room at 2.5 months with 2 collapsed lungs. We actually asked them to test them for SMA. So he was about 2 months, 3 weeks old when we got our diagnosis officially. A lot of damage had already been done.
From the time the blood work was done until we got the diagnosis was about 3 weeks. I do not feel that the doctor who diagnosed us was well informed.
I was diagnosed at 18 months. I started showing symptoms around 12 months old. So it took about 6 months to get a diagnosis, an accurate diagnosis of SMA type 3.
So, John and Nancy, what strikes you in these comments? Obviously, SMA is a journey, and it's a disease that really affects the whole family, not just the patient, the caregivers. And tell us about this diagnostic delay, diagnostic odyssey, as it's referred to sometimes.
Well, I think part of the issue is that SMA is rare and infrequent, so most clinicians, especially at the front line in primary care, will not have encountered many, many cases, and there are many other potential causes for hypotonia and early motor delays. And I think that the fact that most of the motor milestones in the first year or two of life have a really wide variability.
There is variability, yeah.
So that, in a sense, when we're seeing a child who might be just at borderline or mildly delayed in terms of their motor milestones and a bit hypotonic, there's a part of all of us that wants to be very compassionate and root for the child, hope that they're just taking their time to develop normally. But I think that the scenario is really changing now that we have potentially treatable causes, and SMA is one of those very prominent ones, so that knowing that there is treatment available and that the earlier the diagnosis is made and the treatment is initiated, the better the outcome, it really becomes mandatory that we think of SMA and any other potentially treatable cause and screen for them immediately rather than giving the child that luxury of some
wait
lag
and
time.
See. So there is an important balance between wait and see and not
looking
subject
for the treatable
the patient
causes.
For unnecessary burden of invasive testing and so forth. On the other hand, you don't want to delay an important diagnosis that could lead to prompt and early treatment. So let's put this in perspective with the real patient case, Brandon. He was first noted to have poor tone and head control at 2 months. Difficulty gaining weight, and he was hospitalized at 3 months for pneumonia, and workup of his failure to thrive and hypotonia was performed during that hospitalization. And genetic testing confirmed a homozygous SMN1 deletion with an SMN2 copy number of 2. And his initial CHOP-INTEND score was 20. Now, the CHOP-INTEND is the primary motor scale that is used in very young children to kind of monitor their motor function. And this really is quite a classic story and presentation for the classic type 1. Let's move on and see what the data show in terms of the diagnostic delay. Like in this case scenario, It was pretty prompt, but we know that from data that even in type 1, which is the most severe form, which, you know, symptoms are quite severe and early on, there is still an average delay of about 4 months. And remember, you know, time is motor neuron now, and we have intervention. So 4 months is quite a long time. And then if you look at type 2 and type 3, the red bar is when the symptoms start, compared to the blue bar when actually the diagnosis is confirmed. There is a large gap to confirm the diagnosis, certainly for type 3, and then for the rare type 4, that's even more. So what are some of the implications of a diagnostic delay? John?
I think the challenge is that once you lose a motor neuron, it's not going to come back, you know, so we want to try with any intervention that we're making that's disease targeted to get it in as early as possible, because these are irreversible losses that we're dealing with in the nervous system. And as much as you want what's remaining to stay healthy and reinnervate as much as possible, if you lose that initial substrate, you're born with the motor neurons that you have for life. You can't make more of them.
You cannot make new motor neuron. And so, Nancy, can you take us through the clinical presentation and the differential diagnosis? Certainly, we have genetic testing. When should we think about moving towards genetic testing? What other differential should we have in our list? And tell us a little bit, of course, the importance of history taking and the neurological exam. What should we think in differential diagnosis?
Sure. I first want to make the point that the clinical ability to diagnose and suspect spinal muscular atrophy is not something that's going to be irrelevant over time, because as John has pointed out, 95% of the children will show up with a simple genetic test looking for homozygous deletion of SMN1. Newborn screening, by the way, is also based on that same principle, so that, you know, 95% of all cases will be picked up with the newborn screening. But this does leave that very, very important up to 5% who might have absolutely clear-cut responsive to these disease-modifying agents, SMA, who will only be picked up if additional testing is done based on the suspicion of the clinicians.
So the clinical diagnosis is not going to go away. We're still going to be
absolutely
very attentive, because there are also known 5q SMA, other form of SMA that have different genes,
right,
positive genes. So.
Right. But again, this is a rare disorder. So if we talk first about the infantile presentation,
the most severe form, yeah,
where children have low muscle tone and a weakness and some delay in their motor milestones or some loss of motor skills, there are other things that can present very similarly. Most of the things that would present in infancy other than SMA would be things that would have more of a footprint or presence in the newborn period. Things like congenital muscular dystrophy, certain congenital myopathies, congenital myasthenic syndromes, right, congenital myotonic dystrophy, and these. And then there are a few other even more rare forms of SMA. If you try to differentiate those, one of the differentiating features historically will be the relatively more normal newborn period with classical SMA. However, if you have a family with a first child who has born into that family, they may not be able to as clearly differentiate what is a normal newborn
really
period.
Really pick up on the subtle, right, early signs of hypotonia.
Exactly. So that may be a little bit harder to ferret out. But some of the other things that you can look for are the profound decrease in muscle stretch reflexes. They're very difficult to get in a child with classical SMA. Another feature would be the pattern of respiratory weakness. The intercostal muscles are very weak as compared to the diaphragm, which is depended on with babies who have SMA. So therefore, they tend to have more of a bell-shaped chest. And then, because the diaphragm is descending during contraction, it pushes the belly out and up. So they have this paradoxical movement with their abdominal muscles moving up during inspiration, which is atypical for babies.
So this will be the belly breathing
that
belly
we breathing.
Have been trained to recognize. Mm-hmm.
And then the final thing would be the tongue fasciculations, which because
very
of
important.
The denervation of the tongue muscle are very prominent,
yeah,
in babies with SMA. But that can be kind of difficult. You have to look for irregular, involuntary writhing kind of movements within the tongue
and,
substance itself.
In a very
itself.
Young baby, that can be a little bit tricky, but
and
that's
that
certainly
be tricky.
Something to look for.
And those would be things that would make you think more of SMA. But again, if there's any question, the point is to go ahead and do the diagnostic testing.
Right.
Targeted to SMA, not a broad panel with MRI
right.
of the brain and spine and a lot of other things.
Although
will be
maybe
your diagnosis.
For example, for the congenital muscular dystrophy, for example, mm-hmm. a simple test like CK, that could kind of help you kind of tease out some mm-hmm. of those differential. And then in the older mm-hmm. presentation, the older children mm-hmm. or even mm-hmm. adolescents and young adults, what would
be the
differential?
In the older children, they usually present with a decline in their motor function. Inability to run or climb or failing to gain that after they walk, beginning to fall with buckling at the knees. Mm-hmm. Another thing that happens is a tremor, which is a very, very fine tremor. It used to be called mini polymyoclonus, but mm-hmm. basically it's just a fine to and fro even tremor that occurs when they're using right. their extremities, when they're reaching out and all. That and then the very profound decrease in reflexes are a few of the things that will help differentiate that from other things that look very similar on the surface, like limb girdle muscular dystrophies, for example.
So that will be the big differential, like limb girdle muscular dystrophy and other dystrophy, maybe some congenital myopathies.
Right.
And again, the reflexes are very, very important. So, John, take us through the steps of, so if you clinically now suspect maybe SMA in your differential based on your history and the clinical examination, nowadays, what will be the diagnostic algorithm to confirm the diagnosis as soon as possible?
I think in the era of having disease-modifying treatments, we have much greater accessibility to this simple genetic testing. So there's often free or sponsored testing programs, depending on where you are located, that might be available to look for this homozygous deletion of SMN1. If that's present, that's very sensitive and specific for SMA. You have your diagnosis.
So DNA testing can be done through blood or saliva, universally correct. Pretty much available now. It should be your first step, like unlike right. the olden days where we will go maybe to muscle biopsy or more invasive
yeah,
testing.
And you need a rapid turnaround for that
and
test because
quick.
You want to know, especially in the infantile onset, quickly so that you can right. institute treatment as soon as possible.
Usually genetic tests come back in 7 to maybe a couple of weeks.
But
average.
We have some that are now
even
2-day
days.
Turner.
Yeah.
yeah. So if you've done your double deletion test and it's not confirmatory, mm-hmm. then you're obliged to sequence the SMN1 gene because you're looking for a sequence change or an inversion or something as the reason why a copy of SMN1 is non-functional.
The 5% yeah. that you mentioned
yes.
earlier.
So if that also is negative, then you start doing some other neuromuscular related workup, thinking about either non-5Q SMAs or whether you have another localization for what might be causing your symptoms.
And those mm-hmm. tests will include maybe an EMG, the CPK, maybe a muscle biopsy, and those non-5Q SMA types are extremely rare and very heterogeneous, unfortunately, so that's going to be a bigger workup. What about prenatal testing? Are we there, and how is
yeah.
that helping?
I think you brought up the concept of time as motor neuron already. We want to get treatment started as soon as possible, and there have been recommendations here in the United States from the Obstetrics and Gynecology College to screen all pregnant families for carrier status for SMA. If both parents are identified as carriers, they would have a 1 in 4 chance of having an affected fetus, choosing to test your fetus based on what technology might be most appropriate based on the time of gestation can lead to a diagnosis of SMA in a child before they're born. If that happens, we'd strongly encourage referral to a specialized care center for SMA to discuss that result because there's tremendous implications both in terms of what might be planned for the baby when they're born and what kind of interventions might be available, but also genetic counseling of the family and risk to other people who may be thinking about family planning as well.
So these discussions are complex and they're becoming even more complex now with the disease-modifying treatment, and so they really belong in a setting with a good genetic counselor and a neuromuscular specialist. But in terms of newborn screening, it was recently approved, and tell us a little bit about the current state across the United States.
Yes, we've had it on the recommended universal screening panel from the federal government since 2018, but each state has their own approach to whether they're going to implement it in the first place, and if so, what technology that they use. So we've seen rapid implementation across several states. Some were even doing it before the timing of the RUSP, and more have come on board now, with others having adopted but not yet implemented. But you can see from this map that the majority is in darker shades of purple, and so we're hoping for an age where all babies will be screened at birth when born for this disease. Now, it's important to understand where these technologies fail. So on the prenatal side, if a parent has two copies of SMN1 on one allele and zero on the other, this test for homozygous deletion is going to say they're not a carrier because it sees both of those copies, but they can still pass that zero copy allele along with a 1 in 4 chance. And so this can be false negative even in the context of having done prenatal carrier screening.
Yeah, so that's a pitfall that needs to be remembered.
Yes, and then in the context of newborn screening, we bring up this concept again of the 5% that'll be missed because they don't have a homozygous deletion as the reason why they're destined
to have
SMA.
So we still need very savvy and trained clinicians, neuromuscular clinicians for this. And but awfully we're moving towards having universal screening probably in the next 2 to 3 years. But right now we're in a mixed landscape still. So the treatment landscape has changed dramatically in the past few years, in a very exciting way for us as neurology and neuromuscular. In back prior to December 2016, the care of SMA was really, you know, diagnosis and supportive care that was mostly centered on pulmonary support and physical therapy, orthopedic management of contracture and scoliosis. And then in December 2016, we had the first accelerated, very fast approval of the first antisense oligonucleotide. Nusinersen was approved based on remarkable trial data that we're gonna go over in a moment. Newborn screening was approved to be added to the RASP in 2018. And then in May of 2019, AveXis 101 SMN1 gene transfer was approved. And two FDA drugs now approved and more in phase 3 clinical trials being studied as right now. And these are other splice modifiers, some orals that we're gonna discuss briefly. So now let's hear what patients and caregivers have to say regarding their experiences with these new SMA treatments.
Our diagnosing doctor, she was very unaware that there were treatments very close to approval.
I actually brought it up to his neurologist. His neurologist knew nothing about treatment. And it took 11 months after it was approved by the FDA to get him injections.
So Nancy and John, what can we learn from these comments and how can we improve practice and expert access to this treatment?
Well, I think not just with SMA, but with all rare disorders, it's very difficult for everyone to be an expert in everything, including all of the rare disorders. Mm-hmm. And the field and the landscape is changing so rapidly that it's difficult even in major centers to always be at the front of the envelope. So I think that one of the things we need to do is just be aware that this is a very rapidly changing field and make certain to reach out to centers of excellence or centers that emphasize treatment of some of these disorders and that are participating in the cutting edge clinical trials.
So train more and more the next generation of neuromuscular expert becomes very, very important. Yeah. And certainly educating general neurologists, which might not be taking the lead on maybe treating this patient, but they will take the lead and refer them very rapidly to a center with expertise in SMA. So John, let's look at the mechanism of action of the first drug that was approved, nusinersen, who's an antisense oligonucleotide. How is the mechanism of action for this drug?
Nusinersen is a genetically targeted therapy, and so patients with SMA have to have some copies of SMN2. If you have no SMN protein, it's incompatible with life. What nusinersen does is it targets the pre-messenger RNA, so there's been a message transcribed, but it promotes inclusion of that exon 7 that's been missing in the natural state of SMN2 expression. And so more often, exon 7 is included in that final transcribed and translated protein, and you end up getting more functional SMN2 protein made by the SMN2 gene that the patient already has.
So it really acts on the messenger RNA, upregulating the production of a full-length functional SMN protein. Mm-hmm. And by the way, this is a drug that is delivered intrathecally?
Correct. Yeah. The challenge is if you were to take it orally, it wouldn't get where it really needs to go, which is the motor neurons in the spinal cord. And so that direct intrathecal delivery gives the highest concentration of the medication where it needs to be to protect
those motor
neurons.
And it has to be given at certain interval 3 times a year for kind of chronically.
Yeah, that's the maintenance phase. There's a 2-month loading phase to start.
Also, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so the clinical studies for nusinersen, there has been a very large program, different clinical trials. Can you tell us a little bit about the pivotal trials and all the data accumulated so far?
Yeah, it's a remarkable international collaboration to make this happen amongst many different centers. The initial data from phase 2 trials is still being collected in extension studies to understand this treatment in patients with various forms of SMA. But the two pivotal placebo-controlled phase 3 studies were the ENDEAR study, which was carried out in infantile onset SMA, those with onset of symptoms before 6 months of age, and also the CHERISH study, which looked at primarily sitters, although some patients who had walked and lost that ability were able to be included in the criteria.
And by the way, these were phase 3 randomized, they had a sham procedure control arm, which is quite remarkable, but there was a pre-established interim analysis. Both of these phase 3 trials were interrupted early based on that pre-specified interim analysis because of the p-values were so positive towards the treated, so quite
correct.
Remarkable.
And then the one other trial to mention is the NURTURE study, which was open label but looked at patients who were pre-symptomatic or hadn't shown any symptoms or signs of SMA yet and were treated with either 2 copies or 3 copies of the SMN2
gene. So these were babies pre-symptomatic and meant to develop eventually either type 1 or type 2 SMA.
Right, so if you look at the efficacy results from these trials cumulatively in one graph, what you see is that the ENDEAR data, which you can see in the red squares there and the black triangles in the extension study, is a continued improvement over time in motor outcomes, which is the y-axis of the graph is motor milestone achievement. As a neuromuscular specialist, looking at this data always amazes me, because if we were to simply keep people the same in a disease that was destined to lose function, or even lose function at a slower pace than what the natural history would be, that is a therapeutic achievement. But what we're looking at here is continued improvement and stabilization of a disease to allow natural development to happen super.
And reaching milestone that will be unexpected for the natural history.
Yes. If you look at the yellow squares on this graph, that is also encouraging, because these are patients who were initially on sham control. So they had, like the gray triangles, a natural history of loss for the first part of the trial, but then started on treatment and began to gain. And so this implies that there still is a salvageable aspect of motor neuron function that can be targeted even in those who have symptomatically progressed SMA. Yes. But then the lines that all of us are really heartened by are the top two, which are the patients in the NURTURE study who were treated before they had symptoms of SMA. And you can see that those lines are very close to normal development in terms of achievement of motor milestones. So if we look at what this means practically in terms of milestone achievement with the NURTURE data, you can see that many of these patients are sitting, they're gaining head control, they're beginning to pull the stand, and at the last data cut, many of them were walking independently.
I think 100% all of them were actually sitting independently, even the one with 2 copies, right?
Yes.
And all of the one with 3 copies were walking, and I think probably the majority of the one with 2 copies were achieving the milestone. And the other thing, I think that some were achieving this milestone at the age kind of a normal age. Mm-hmm.
So the themes that are emphasized are earlier treatment is better, but that there is a role for treatment across the spectrum of SMA severity.
And here we just showed just what we just discussed about the reaching the milestone, like sitting, walking, crawling, and standing, and so forth. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So thank you, John. And now moving on to the onasemnogene abeparvovec, or AVX-101. Nancy, how does this agent work, and what does the data show in different SMA population?
This has a completely different mechanism of action. This is a treatment that aims to replace the SMN1 gene. So the SMN1 gene has been synthesized, and this synthetic gene is then packaged within the viral capsid of an adeno-associated virus, the type 9. They selected one that was not likely to create a big immune reaction, that not very many people had been exposed to, that wasn't going to incorporate into the human genome, it requires production of many, many copies. There are, I believe, the target doses for the intravenous therapy of a single dose, an infusion of 3 × 10^13 power.
And this is delivered through an IV, right?
Right.
In the
trial that has been finished and the FDA approval for use in children under the age of 2 was for an intravenous infusion over, you know, part of 1 to 2 hours. The early trials you can see here demonstrated that with a good safety experience, but the initial experience did demonstrate a reaction with elevation of liver functions that was felt to be an immediate immune reaction. So the additional trials after the very first patient were treated with oral prednisolone, 1 mg/kg/day, 1 day before the IV infusion, and then continuing for a month with gradual tapers over the next several months. You can see here that the first trials were in infants who were symptomatic and 6 or 7 months of age, with the first introductory dose meant really for safety evaluation. And there was some stabilization and improvement in their motor milestones, but it wasn't very dramatic. Once that degree of safety was identified, an additional trial was initiated, or the extension of that trial, involved both increasing to the target dose in humans based on their estimation of the therapeutic target based on animal trials, as well as targeting younger children.
So most of the 12 patients on the right
on
inside,
the right,
those are therapeutic dose, 12 patients.
Right, with most of them treated under 4 or 5 months of age.
Right.
And you can see that there was a very dramatic improvement in their motor scale scores. In fact, you can see the chop and tend bar there at 40, and that's sort of the natural history experience suggesting that children with SMA who are untreated never reach during their any point in their development.
Usually they linger around the 20s, low 20s. If they do gain a couple of points, they'll eventually very fast lose them past 6 months.
Because most of them are progressive from the point in time when they first are diagnosed.
Yeah.
And that's very different than the history here, where you can see the treated children very rapidly improved. Now, because this is a weight-based treatment, the number of genes that had to be synthesized and packaged in this way is very impressive once you get to larger and older children. So the second trial, which is still ongoing. Involves using smaller doses but directly intrathecally administered as a single lumbar puncture, single
infusion,
intrathecal dose.
Yeah.
And this has been done in a number of children already up to 5 years of age. And you can see here, just looking at the numbers of children who've been treated between 6 and 24 months of age. The dark bars are those who've achieved those milestones prior to treatment. And then the period of observation at this data capture was usually somewhat less than 1 year, mm-hmm. but even within that 1 year extension, you can see the gray bar extensions are those who were treated with the single intrathecal dose and then continued or gained milestones, which again is not common in the natural history of spinal muscular atrophy. But you could compare that with this next graph, which looks at that small group of children who were treated a little bit later, between 2 and 5 years of age, mm-hmm. and you can see that the fraction of them who over the next 3/4 of a year of observation gained new milestones was somewhat less, showing the same kind of information with this gene replacement therapy that we saw with the ASO, which is that the earlier the treatment, it seems like the better the outcomes.
Yeah, for example, with standing, you know, that's an acquired skill that would be unexpected.
Right.
And so, Nancy, tell us a little bit about monitoring patients for side effects.
The monitoring for nusinersen is really based on both the general experience with antisense oligonucleotide therapy in all people, as well as these trials that John described. There were some individuals who historically in ASO trials or treatment had developed clotting problems and urine proteinuria because of the impact on the kidney. This has been very infrequent in the experience of the trials with nusinersen, but nevertheless, the packaging recommends that before each dose that the children have clotting studies and urine protein checked. There have been a number of children who, during the period of observation, and now there have been several hundred children treated and monitored over time, who have developed hydrocephalus, and people are continuing to observe that to determine the relatedness and what to make of that over time.
It's so a very small number of cases.
It's a very small number. Yeah. I think it was 3, but blood work monitoring prior to each mm-hmm. dose, overall the safety, mild to moderate though overall. The gene transfer for the AveXis 101, mm-hmm. how do we monitor?
It appears that the biggest response is an immune one to this large number of foreign protein and viral capsids and the synthetic gene. There appears to be a variable degree of liver function elevation or hypertransaminitis that develops despite the pre-treatment with the oral prednisone. This has been pretty manageable over time. Usually what it requires is either increasing or extending the duration of the oral steroid therapy.
And it's asymptomatic, so in these cases you can see elevation of the liver enzyme, but the patient
For the most part, it's been clinically asymptomatic
versus there is a potential risk for true liver failure, but very rare, but that mm-hmm. is in the label, in fact.
Right. There is a not infrequent decrease in platelet count that's felt to be complement mediated, you know, at 7 to 10 days. And then there are just the, this is something that's much newer, and we're continuing, as I mentioned, the trial on the older children is continuing. And there are some issues that have been observed in animal trials, right. having to do with change in markers of heart function and also changes in pathology of sensory neurons, that it's unknown whether this will have any significance for humans, and so this will be monitored.
That safety data is still being monitoring. Right. The trials are ongoing, so it's important to remember that this agent was only approved May of 2019.
Right.
So we have more data coming, and so these are now in the post-commercial phase, FDA approved, but. John, what do we have in phase 3 clinical trials coming down the pikes for more potential drugs for SMA? Maybe concentrating on risdiplam, which I think is
Yeah, at the start of 2020, we're hopeful that the next entry into the clinical arena may be small molecule therapy. So this technology, again, takes advantage of these SMN2 genes in terms of increasing the expression of SMN protein through alternative splicing. But the advantage of these agents is that they can be delivered orally or via G-tube, which is less complex to do than intrathecal therapy, but also allows for systemic expression of SMN protein to other tissues, which may have an advantage to it as we have people living different lives with SMA on treatment. These have been studied primarily in Europe, but also in the United States. And there's ongoing studies that have had data presented at recent academic meetings. Similar to other programs, there's been different populations studied. So the FIREFISH study was open label in infantile onset SMA, and the SUNFISH study looks at patients 2 to 25 years of age with milder forms, SMA type 2 or 3 based on natural history. There's also a JEWELFISH study, which is inclusive of patients who have been treated with other SMA-targeted therapies and then switch to risdiplam.
That's interesting because that includes true adult patients up to 60 years of age, which
Correct.
Is, you know, so it's a broad spectrum of ages in mm-hmm. this program.
And then similar to others, there's also a pre-symptomatic trial called RAINBOWFISH where patients are treated before the onset of SMA symptoms. Mm-hmm. Symptoms. And so if you look at the FIREFISH study in terms of efficacy, you can see that there is a achievement of a score greater than 40 on the CHOP INTEND in the majority of patients. They're sitting, they have head control, a small number are standing. And in terms of tolerability, there's been no significant safety events reported. Initially with this development program, there was some concerns about retinal toxicity, but that hasn't perpetuated in later iterations of the studies. And now it's things like fever, upper respiratory infection, constipation, which were things that were seen in all of the studies related to SMA.
So not any emergent serious side effects so far.
Correct.
So Nancy, can you give us an overview of the SMA care guidelines? And we want to stress, of course, that because we do have new disease-modifying treatment, it is still extremely important to really care for this patient mm-hmm. a multidisciplinary approach. We cannot forget about, these are obviously so far not cures, so what is required in terms of clinical care?
Well before the introduction of the disease-modifying therapies in 2016, it was shown that there were different types of supportive cares, assuring good nutrition, assuring clearance of airways and adequate ventilation, particularly during sleep when everyone breathes a little bit more shallowly, minimizing problems with bone and contractures and managing scoliosis, all of these things. Doing those actually improved outcomes, and there was some data to that end even before we came to the much more potent treatment of the disease-modifying therapies. But one of the most important things, I think, to emphasize right now in the era of disease-modifying therapies is that there is still this pool, we believe, of vulnerable motor neurons that are still, you know, not thriving perfectly, but at risk and vulnerable, that would not only have some response to the other therapies, but also respond to the same supportive cares that we've noted all along, so that the better nutrition, the better ventilation.
So it's very important to still deliver all the other supportive care.
Exactly. So that despite the wonderful disease-modifying therapies, all patients with SMA should be monitored and continue to provide that
very proactively with the goal to really improve quality of life.
Exactly.
So, and that is very important. Mm-hmm. And in the care guidelines, I think that the way they have described the guidelines is for non-sitters, sitters, and walkers, because mm-hmm. obviously these are kind of different groups rather than stick with mm-hmm. the number of copies of SMN2. It's really what functional level is that particular patient at, what should be monitored proactively and what to do. And
these guidelines have been not only published in the Journal of Neuromuscular Disorders, but also available from Cure SMA for families as well as for
primary
clinicians
care and
neurologists and other neuromuscular people. to provide them with guidance. And the classification, which lists the best motor skill, like non-sitters or sitters and walkers, pertains to not just the orthopedic care that needs to be provided, but obviously, because non-sitters have weakness in their axial muscles, they're more subject to problems with swallowing and breathing, and therefore
the cares are really different for
the kind of supportive
patients,
care would be much more extensive.
So care coordination is a critical aspect of SMA care. Let's hear what the patients and caregivers have to say about their experiences.
There's been minimal care team.
Basically going on around, and then four or five different types of doctors or rounds of doctors that have come through, and we wouldn't have to really move rooms. And I really enjoyed that part of the clinic.
Yes, I do have follow-up in a multidisciplinary clinic. My doctors are in communication with each other for the most part, and then there's a social worker to coordinate care between them.
So John and Nancy, what jumps out at you in these comments from the patients? What does it take to really have a good multidisciplinary clinic that works?
Yeah, I think the challenge is it's not a one-size-fits-all solution. It depends a lot on the resources that you have available in your local care context. Maybe everybody can be in one shared clinic space. Maybe you're relying on some referral and coordination of care, but you're trying to really optimize the life of the person living with SMA, considering also all the psychosocial implications and everything else that they might face.
So one is minimizing the trips to different subspecialty, have them there.
And also being conscious that interfacing with the medical system is a challenge for these patients because you're coming into an area where you're more at risk of being exposed to infections, which they're more prone to stress related to. But you're trying to get all of the different aspects of what is a very complicated multisystem disorder optimized as much as possible, and then also monitor the effects of these treatments on the patients as well, that we need to be continuously looking for the clinical outcomes in our patients so that we can continue to advocate for their use and also monitor for any potential long-term implications that we are not aware of yet because these are also new.
And some of these scales like the CHOP, the HINE, the Hammersmith, these are very quite specialized, requires physical therapists that are trained in monitoring, the improvement in these patients. So
and the time in the natural history of each person that they'll need the specialists may be very, very different.
Right.
I think the need for the genetics and genetic counselors is very, very great at the beginning when the family needs a lot of guidance, either with results of newborn screening or making decisions, and then looking at the needs of the extended family in terms of counseling, as well as we're hoping later on as the individuals with SMA may need additional genetic counseling with
so
respect
really
to their own families, yeah.
Yeah, and so this leads us, John, what do you think the future of SMA moving forward? How is the landscape and treating, and are we gonna have an all different landscape moving forward?
As much as the progress up until this point is remarkable, there's still a lot of unanswered questions and a lot to explore that we're all very excited about as a community to think about the way that the phenotype is evolving on treatment and what optimal management is from an orthopedic, a pulmonary, a nutrition standpoint as patients are shifting categories, that people who were destined to be non-sitters are now achieving milestones, but in a very different way than what would be seen in the natural history of SMA and what is the right way to support those patients. And then to start thinking about as we get more and more therapeutic options into the arena, are there ways that we could potentially combine approaches or time them at different aspects of development for different patients depending on the severity of their phenotype? Are there other biomarkers that will help us understand better how people are going to behave beyond the SMN2 copy number to help us optimally support somebody and have them have the best possible life living with SMA.
So certainly moving forward, more treatment at the pre-symptomatic stage, most likely, but discovery of perhaps new phenotypes.
And I think there'll have to be a lot more post-marketing monitoring of the families or the individuals if we're going to be getting into combinations and new therapies and things
effect.
Like that. So that we really know what the outcome is.
Okay, wonderful. So thank you, Nancy and John, for the great discussion. Let us now summarize the key takeaways or SMART goals. Simple genetic testing will pick up 95% of cases of spinal muscular atrophy. There are now disease-modifying therapies available, and data suggests that early diagnosis and treatment lead to optimal outcomes. And the importance of implementing strategies for multidisciplinary care coordination for patients with SMA guided by a neuromuscular specialist cannot be emphasized enough. Thank you all for joining us. I encourage you to visit the CME Outfitters website for a comprehensive list of clinical resources, additional educational activities for both providers and patients. Welcome back. We have received quite a number of questions. The first question says, should we refer patients for CSF testing to determine best treatment option?
I think the challenge there is that's not an easily accessible tissue, right? So you want to try to look for things that are easily testable in patients. And we don't have great data about any biomarker being correlated to the severity of SMA in terms of SMN protein expression, for example. But I think, Nancy, you've been involved in quite a bit of work related to neurofilament, right? Is that something that people have been looking at recently?
I think, as we mentioned earlier, people are looking for other biomarkers. And with the nusinersen studies, there was CSF that was obtained for research collected at the same time that the treatments were administered intrathecally. And people have noted that the neurofilament light levels appear to have responded. The question is, do we have enough information about what the natural change? It does appear that in newborns it's much higher than it is later in life naturally, and the exact rate at which it declines in people who don't have SMA hasn't yet been charted out. So I think that this is a very, very promising area of a potential guidance and for another biomarker, but we're not there yet.
And speaking of biomarkers, one of the viewers is asking, is there data on creatine levels and correlation to disease severity? Can it be used as a biomarker, the CK?
Or creatine.
It says creatine levels, so creatine levels.
I think the challenge
can comment on both.
Determining creatine or other markers is that people with these neuromuscular disorders have lower muscle bulk in general, and so a lot of these markers are harder to interpret in those populations, and you have to have some sort of normative data in the natural history, which is rapidly disappearing because we have all these patients on therapy now.
So in terms of for the kidney toxicity, certainly creatine is not a good one in our neuromuscular population in general, but certainly for SMA, that's why we go to protein in the urine to monitor the kidney toxicity for the antisense oligonucleotide. And then for the CPK, I don't think that that's a very useful biomarker, if that was at this time. And then the next question, as primary care, I manage overall health of patients who has muscle disorders and see increased incidence of infection, pulmonary disease, and hypoglycemia. Any issues or concern I should be aware of? Assuming SMA patients.
Well, I think that we mentioned the fact that SMN proteins needed beyond the motor neuron, and there are a number of individuals with more severe disease, type 1s, and this very, very rare newborn onset type 0, who appear to have some degree of beta oxidation defect, so they are subject to hypoglycemia with prolonged fasting. If that's seen, I think what you need to do is try to make sure that you avoid fasting, so that if there are any treatments or any other issues, or even overnight, a child not tolerating that length of a relative fast, to try to provide supplements and things that would treat that as a specific issue.
Yeah, and also going back to the standard of care, immunizations, RSV, prophylaxis, all of these things are still important to maintain even in the era of people being on treatment.
Yeah. And then, of course, for some of these, especially the young ones that end up maybe in the PICU in the winter season with pneumonia or respiratory problems, there are actually extubation protocols that can be very helpful.
I think that the children with SMA who are under a year old many times are given Synagis as a preventive am agent, just like the very ill and tiny premature babies under a year of age are given. That's another.
So we have a question. This is an important question. Are both treatments approved in infants to adults? How do the agent differ in dosing and side effects and onset of action? So we need to clarify. So nusinersen is approved for all ages, all type of SMA, at least per label. So. And for the AveXis 101, it's only so far approved for patients 0 to 24 months of age, so not for adults. And in terms of onset of action, John, you want to comment about onset of action for the two different drugs?
I think it's challenging when you try to look across the different studies because all were slightly different in terms of their baseline populations and their timing of monitoring and what outcome measures they were using. But the general theme is that there's not a time-locked response for any of these therapies, that it really depends on how symptomatic the patient was when you got them on therapy and what age they were when they were that symptomatic. So in other sense, how severe their disease is, when you detected it, and when you got them onto treatment, that has implications. So it's, again, emphasizing this theme of as soon as possible getting treatment started, which means diagnosing as soon as possible when somebody has SMA.
And I think that for nusinersen, looking at those graphs over and over of the published trials, there is a sense that, you know, it can start in quite early, you know, the more severe, the sooner, obviously. But then there is a trend that they don't really plateau. They keep on going up slowly over time. There isn't like a plateau generally. That's the sense. Of course, in the type 3, in the ambulatory, less severe patients, you know, it takes longer because maybe all you're seeing is stabilization of their motor function rather than, you know, significant improvement. So, and then for the AveXis, I think that there are some reports that, you know, obviously the replication starts quite early. And some effects have been seen even at 1 month. Can you talk about the management of spine deformities in this patient? Best option based on data? Nancy?
I think there are so many areas of natural history of spinal muscular atrophy, particularly treated, where we just don't have any natural history data or any observations to really do this. I think that we people historically have been using the principles that orthopedists and rehabilitation physicians and neuromuscular specialists have learned from treating scoliosis in weak patients as compared to treating scoliosis in just idiopathic variety and healthy, strong individuals. One of the issues comes is that that comes up is that frequently the severity of the scoliosis is such that people want to address it before children reach their growth potential, before they stop growing. And the new introduction of things like growing rods,
where the magic rods,
Vector and growing rods and magic rods, where either repeat surgeries or now with magnetic guidance, some of the mechanical devices used to correct the scoliosis can actually be lengthened to match the child's growth.
And then it remains to be seen if with this disease-modifying agent moving forward, we're going to see less of scoliosis development.
Exactly. That,
or different kinds.
Or different kinds of scoliosis.
Because sometimes patients who are a little bit weaker but then gain the ability to sit through changing category from non-sitter to sitter are different than those who were sitting and then had progression of their disease and became weaker. So I think they're going to be different in how we manage them.
John, I think that one of the viewers has a question. Again, can you explain the negative screening again? I think the negative
newborn screening.
Prenatally, if the parent has 0 on one allele and 2 on the other allele of SMN1, they can still pass that 0 along, but they will be detected as non-carrier because the test sees both of those SMN1 genes. So that's a false negative result, and it varies by ethnicity. It's more common in African Americans, for example, to have this change, but that's an important thing to know when you're counseling a family about a test result related to prenatal screening. the newborn screen is highly specific if it's detected, but still misses those who have a sequence change or something other than a deletion as the reason why the SMN.
So it picks 95% because those are deletion, but for that 5% that might be a different type of mutation, you need sequencing, and that will not come through the newborn screening. Will have through clinical confirmation or suspicion.
Yes, and most states are choosing not to screen for carrier status, so they only screen for true homozygous deletion, not for having only one copy missing.
Right.
And so you don't know if you're at risk of having a child with SMA through your newborn screening test.
One of the issues with respect to newborn screening, I think that we should try to address a little, although I think the answer will only come over time with a lot of experience collectively, is what people do with that screen, because we'll get the fact that it's a positive absence of SMN1 and will be provided with a copy count of SMN2. And again, we're hoping for more biomarkers over time to give us additional guidance. But right now, in real time, people will be meeting with families and genetic counselors and all, where we'll have to deal with what are the treatment options. We've talked so much about there being earlier a benefit to earlier treatment. Anticipating this, a number of individuals were brought together by Cure SMA, and there is one article in the literature and now a letter to the editor to follow up on that, talking about what consensus experts might offer teams around the country in dealing with this result of newborn screening. And in general, from the very beginning, people were feeling that if there were two or three copies of SMN2, that they would recommend immediate pre-symptomatic treatment. The question came with, well, what about with four copies? And there was, about a year ago when this first was being discussed, no consensus in the group. We couldn't reach absolute consensus. People have been thinking about it a little bit more and now are recommending in this letter to the editor that even with four copies of SMN2, that those children be offered early treatment. And that's for several reasons. One of the hesitations before was that people weren't as good about detecting and clarifying that it was four copies rather than five, six, or more. Now they've got better technology and can be clearer that it's only four copies. The other thing is that the longer you wait to introduce treatments, for example, like the AAV9 associated gene replacement, the longer interval the person has to potentially be exposed to that virus so that they would have antibodies and be ineligible for the gene replacement. And then finally, just the additional ongoing information talking about or demonstrating that early treatment is helpful in all circumstances.
Right.
So that's one of the things that people will be doing, but I don't want to imply that there are clear answers to all of this. I think this is going to be a very complicated discussion.
Yeah. And
we'll all be learning.
The curve is very steep and
yes.
fast.
We'll all be learning
the field is changing rapidly, but we don't have all the answers. We have a practical question here from a OB practitioner. Is it safe for mothers to breastfeed patients with muscle disorders? I assume with SMA, any risk, and maybe we can expand it to what if they are treated with either nusinersen or AVXS 101. Any concern for breastfeeding?
I think there's multiple layers to how this is complicated. So the first is that generally breastfeeding is preferred for somebody who is safe to swallow, but if somebody's having issues with their coordination, sometimes it's not possible to breastfeed if you have bulbar weakness. If you're considering gene transfer therapy, and the mother is antibody positive, then it's possible that she passed those antibodies along to her infant. And if that's the case, sometimes repeating those antibody tests serially can allow them to fall to a level where treatment is safe. The recommended level is 1 in 50.
That's after stopping breastfeeding,
yes.
If the mom has the antibodies.
Right. But if the mother is not seropositive and the baby is not seropositive, then you can continue breastfeeding even in the context of gene transfer therapy, based on the current label.
And then, of course, some severe babies, like with the type 1, they are not really able to breastfeed successfully due to the bulbar weakness.
Yeah.
That's also...
So
can you go through details of treatment dose and duration with each agent and any experience you have on increasing dose? and how you assess efficacy, and any data on combination therapy. So these are drugs where there is a very specific dose. So for AVXS 101 is based on weight and is a one-time dose. So that's what should be used. For nusinersen, it's a one dose fits all. It's
12 milligrams
dose, in 5
ml. 2 months loading phase, and then a every 4 month maintenance phase.
But again, these things are still under investigation.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that even for nusinersen, there is some potential further studying about maybe different doses, higher doses. But any data on combination therapy, actually, that in the clinical setting, people, of practitioners, are already talking about, and many of us have treated now young infants with both of these available treatment indeed. So as we touch a little bit, John, we think that maybe that might be the future, that there might be a combination.
Yeah, I think that the struggle is there's very little peer-reviewed data about this. Some of the patients that were in the original gene therapy trial did subsequently go on to nusinersen treatment, for example. And then there were patients already on commercial nusinersen who received gene transfer through an early access program before the therapy was approved. So we do have some data in both directions that was collected in a somewhat structured manner. But now that they're both in the clinic, there's also people that are being treated, and we're just going to have
clinically
to learn as a community.
And this brings us to another interesting question. So this is important. Are pre-symptomatic babies being treated outside of clinical trials currently? Yes, absolutely yes. So pre-symptomatic. So in states where the newborn screening is already ongoing, obviously that's the way we practice. Like, they come to us, the majority, 95%, come at the pre-symptomatic stage, and we have two commercially approved medication to choose from. So yes, totally. In those states where there is no newborn screening, we're still relying on the clinical diagnosis, so they could come to you either pre-symptomatic, based on family history perhaps, or at the symptomatic. But yes, you have two medication to choose from. And then any tips for getting access to treatment for patients and families? So access, this issue of, you know, approval versus access.
I think the key point is you have to meet a care team at a center that really focuses on SMA, because they're going to give you a comprehensive approach to your individualized circumstance in terms of what options there are for treatment, and then also be familiar with the different mechanisms for getting those treatments to happen for the person.
Yeah, so the decision of what drugs, combination, yes or no, what kind of outcome measure to follow the response, because you're going to have to decide, is it worth it to continue, is it working, is it not working. So they're very, very complex strategies. So I think the patients are best served to have at least a multidisciplinary center with expertise in SMA, and then they can be co-managed with their more local physician. I think that in terms of access also, it's because the people that do, let's say, SMA or neuromuscular disorder as 100% of their practice, they're going to have that infrastructure and team to really work on getting treatment quickly and efficiently. So if you have 50 patients with SMA versus this is the first patient ever came to your practice, obviously you're not set up to do that fast. And this is a very relevant question. Is there any benefit of nusinersen treatment in an older individual, 69 years old, who has type 3 SMA? I guess I'm not the adult neurologist here, I would say. So it's interesting because the data for really adult patients in nusinersen are a little bit less than for the type 1 and type 2, but obviously the label cover all ages, all types. And I have to tell you that about one-third of patients in real life treated in the world are actually adult patients with SMA. And I think we're coming to have emerging literature now published about actually benefits motor improvement in older patients. These are obviously not randomized clinical trials for 69 years old, but real life clinical practice. And I certainly, the oldest patient I have personally treated was 59. So I think that generally the approach is, if you have an adult that you want to consider treatment, as long as you decide what kind of outcome measure to follow so that you can decide if they're actually benefiting for the drug. And of course, because natural history is so much slower in older patients, you will have to decide if lack of decline is good enough, or if you really want to see improvement in certain scale. One of the scale that we use most in this age group, if they're ambulatory, of course, the 6 minutes walk or the 100 feet go. If they're non-ambulatory, then there is a scale that calls the upper limb module that really focus more on the upper limb, and that can be very, very helpful. I've seen patients gaining 2 or 3 points on that scale, and that can really make a big difference in real life functioning. We have a social worker, please, she says, please remind your audience of how important it is to have us on the team. Absolutely, yes. Social worker in the multidisciplinary clinic, so many aspects of social working, you know, community access. These are patients that might need access to go to college, to school, resources in the community, dealing with insurance coverage for equipment, wheelchairs.
And also the behavioral health aspects, both of living with SMA yourself and sometimes how different stress points in life can affect you differently if you're living with chronic disease, but also the effect that this can have on caregivers and burnout and other things that we need to be vigilant for in our clinics, that we're supporting all of the people that are involved in the care network that somebody has, that to make sure that we're addressing that aspect of health as well.
Absolutely.
So this is an important question. They say, outstanding program, thank you very much. Can you comment on how to find a pediatric muscle disorder specialist in your area? So I think that we will probably recommend on the website of Cure SMA. I think it's curesma.com. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Cure SMA will pop
Maybe
up.
Org.
And
yes.
They list all the specialized center for SMA as mm-hmm. clinical center, and also they list their treating centers
yeah.
for the different therapies, and they update their website quite timely. They also have that nice map of the newborn screening state if you're interested in knowing what's going on with that part. Mm-hmm. I am a pharmacist. Please talk about the important role in gaining approval and getting access. Nancy, tell us a little bit. And obviously, pharmacist is another specialty pharmacy, and pharmacies for the team, extremely important.
Well, you know, there are some third-party insurances that are national, and there are others that are very state-specific, for example, some of the public insurances. And each of those has to come up with a policy about how to deal with this. Some of them also take expensive infusion type of treatment and make it be a separate benefit from the regular health care. And so some of them will demand that you deal with specialty pharmacies. And some hospitals will themselves assist families and the team in procuring the drug. So this will be something that will look very different in different parts of the country.
Right.
But pharmacists have been absolutely critical in all of this.
Yeah. Can you comment on the team you use for treatment of patients, team you use for dosing nusinersen? So,
I think the challenge is that it's so patient-specific because you have a heterogeneity of the type of patient that you're trying to target and what their needs might be around the procedure. And so some patients can, they're ambulatory and they have no scoliosis and it's very straightforward to do a lumbar puncture in them and they're fine. Others have significant respiratory support needs and you're worried about positioning comfort related to their contractures. They have curvature of the spine, which makes access more challenging,
so
and we need to use imaging guides guidance or interventional radiology to get access. And then also many of our patients need some sort of support for the procedure as well. And so figuring out what the right level of either anesthesia or sedation is for the individual
patient.
We
always want to use the least possible sedation
but
or certainly anesthesia.
Make it possible for them to do repeatedly without it being traumatic too. So,
and maybe to conclude, this has been a good discussion. Can you predict when the next round of disease-modifying treatment might be available, Nancy?
It's in the hands of the FDA.
Right.
Risdiplam has already been submitted, and I think we have to wait and see. We're all hopeful it'll be within the next, hear something in the next 6 months, but
yeah, the same maybe
it's in the hands of FDA. Yeah.
Yes.
And this what's also amazing to me is, you know, it's always, okay, there's this, but then what next?
You
know, we've made
else.
Such amazing strides, but there's still so much we can do.
So the program is, of the pipelines is very rich, and I wouldn't be surprised if we might have even three treatment by next spring, and so more questions, more learning.
More potential for combinations. I just hope as we move forward with one last comment that we can work out a way so that we have the opportunity to embrace all the patients with SMA so that it's not just because of cost or other factors something that's being limited to the newborns and the potential for really incredible benefit with the newborns. But sometimes we've had the opportunity to treat patients of all ages, and sometimes a very small increase, something that you might not even measure on a scale,
make a big difference.
Completely turns around the quality of life for that patient.
Quality
makes them
of life,
independent and really keeps them, gainfully employed, for example.
Yeah. We do need better outcome measure moving forward, no doubts, for different ages. So this has been a great discussion. Thank you so much, John and Nancy, for joining me. And thank you very much to our audience for joining us and for providing very insightful questions. Thank you very much.